You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
They destroy the sculpture. I think they cut it up in pieces and put it into the container.
At the center of the debate about Hong Kong's financial and political sovereignty, about its role as a free market economy and pro-democracy bastion, with an increasingly hostile administrator, is a statue.
For more than two decades, a sculpture has stood at a university commemorating the victims of the Tiananmen Square massacre.
The area around the 8-meter-high Pillar of Shame was boarded up and workers wheeled away in sections. Its removal is part of China's crackdown on dissent.
This is still my property, and you can't take it away.
That's Jens Galschiot.
I'm living in Denmark. I'm a sculpture man. I have a big workshop here and making art installation all over the world.
Jens is the artist behind the Pillar of Shame.
I think it's the most well-known sculpture now in the world, nearly.
It's a haunting 26-foot-tall copper-cased monument commemorating the victims of the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre.
And this is about 60 bodies around. The most of them is dead. They're going around screaming or something like that. So this it looked like the Eiffel Tower.
And on December 23rd, 2021, under cloak of darkness, Hong Kong University officials dismantled the statue.
I was shocked.
That's journalist Louisa Lim. She grew up in Hong Kong.
I think it's so chilling for any Hong Konger who walks past those sites. They know what was there before and they know what they meant.
Etched into the base of the Pillar of Shame, with its contorted faces of human suffering, is a phrase: the old cannot kill the young forever. And for 25 years, the statue stood undisturbed in an open-air corridor outside of Hong Kong University's student union.
And you have to understand the role that statue plays in the University of Hong Kong. So every year on June the 4th, the students actually go and wash the statue. And it's a very moving moment.
Today marks 32 years since the Beijing massacre.
It was the day that changed modern China and which the government is determined to forget.
To remove an object like that and assume that it will be expunged from people's memories in that way, it's just not something that happens in Hong Kong.
To appreciate why Hong Kongers feel so strongly about the Pillar of Shame, you need to hear its origin story, which in many ways runs parallel to today's saga.
But no one thought it would come to this: a brutal massacre of Chinese students and other protesters by the Chinese army. The death count goes on tonight, and it is at least in the hundreds. It may go as high as 1,000 or more, and the fighting is not yet.
On June 4th, 1989, Jens followed along with the rest of the world as footage of young pro-democracy demonstrators being mowed down by Chinese soldiers was beamed all over the world.
At the moment when it happened, I think it was New York Times, they print a special newspaper and send it out and ask people who have fax to print it out in the whole China to everybody who have a fax. And they have thousands of fax numbers.
To break through China's wall of media censorship, students and journalists from Michigan to Hong Kong rallied people from all over the world to fax photographs and newspaper clippings to every number printed in the Chinese Yellow Pages.
And I was a part of these people who faxed it out. And I was really touched about that because I don't think the Chinese system was good. So I think this is the reason I will take my first Pillar of Shame to put there.
Some years pass after the massacre, and Jens works on other sculpture projects in Europe. But in 1993, he gets to thinking, has the world forgotten about Tiananmen Square?
So then I think I will try to make a monument who remember what happened.
So for 3 years, Jens throws his entire self into building this statue. He spends all of his money.
About $100,000, I think.
On labor and materials.
I worked for 3 years in clay, 7 tons of clay.
And finally, in 1996, the statue is complete. But that's just the beginning of the story.
The only way to get it inside China, you can't get a sculpture like that inside a dictature like China, but you could put it in Hong Kong, and this was the only possibility to put a sculpture inside China.
Jens was facing a bit of a deadline.
The entire world will be watching when Hong Kong is handed over to China on July 1st, 1997.
The statue's only chance of making it to Hong Kong was for it to be shipped across the Indian Ocean before the handover from Great Britain to Beijing. So Jens reached out to the now jailed co-founder of the Democratic Party of Hong Kong, Albert Ho, to develop a political pressure campaign for the statue's arrival.
I have really big connection before, a long time before, with the Chinese democracy movement, because if you do the thing I do, then you must be connected to a movement.
He found a boat.
This firm, big shipping firm, who helped us to transport the container, they warned them from the Chinese government and say, if you take this container and put it in Hong Kong, then you can't work in China anymore. So this firm put the container to the harbor of Hong Kong, and then they left there and said, okay, we don't want to do anything with that.
Eventually, they did find someone with a crane to help them get it out of the harbor. But Chinese authorities, who had spent the last 8 years minimizing the footprint of the Tiananmen Square massacre in mainland China, made it clear they didn't want the statue to come out of that shipping container. But the people of Hong Kong, under the auspices of the One Country, Two Systems Declaration, were left to wonder, if you don't allow this sculpture to come in before you take over, what will happen on July 1st? That's how, on June 5th, 1997, Jens found himself in a sea of young Hong Kong demonstrators marching behind a truck that carried his statue.
They're trying to get the truck and the Pillar of Shame into the area, to the student's house. And the leader of the university, the authority of the university, said nobody's allowed to come in here.
Finally, at 3 a.m., after hours of scuffles with the police, students succeeded in moving the two-ton statue onto the podium of the Hocking Wong building at the University of Hong Kong.
I think they made a good fight for freedom from expression here.
I mean, in the mainland, it's surprising the extent to which that memory has, over the years, been systematically eradicated, sort of excised from people's memories.
And again, Louisa Lim.
And you know, for so many years, Hong Kongers have been carrying the burden of memory because they know that mainlanders have not been able to. And you know, they will continue to remember, but I think some of that burden is now being passed beyond Hong Kong. Now it's becoming harder to remember in Hong Kong as well.
But there's a bit of a silver lining. With the help of an artist collective called Lady Liberty, Jens was able to create a 3D rendering of his statue. And just days after it was dismantled by officials in Hong Kong, he released its copyright.
This is the problem with art. If you move a sculpture, then you make a new symbol.
On June 4th, 2022, a 30-foot replica of the Pillar of Shame will be erected in Taiwan. And it's being replicated all around the world.
You could find print everywhere. At the moment, we have another copy, we put it in Oslo, and we have a smaller copy, we have just put it in Hungaria, and we have one go to Amsterdam.
But in Hong Kong, the question of the statue's removal now looms larger than ever. Can China erase Hong Kong's history of democracy and independence, of free speech? That's the question we explore on this week's episode of World Affairs. We start with Louisa Lim. Her latest book is Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. Right out of the gates, we're with you on a rooftop in Hong Kong as a sort of guerrilla artists prepare posters and slogans and signs. It is a unique vantage point. And also, you're watching the sort of opening salvos of Hong Kong's current struggle, aren't you?
That's right. And that very first scene, actually, it was right before National Day. So it was at the end of September in 2019. And I had been contacted by these guerrilla sign painters who were very famous, but I had no idea who their identities were, who they were. But they painted these gigantic protest banners. They were normally sort of 7, 8, 9 stories high. And then in the dead of the night, they would get climbers to scale the tallest mountains in Hong Kong and drape them out over from the mountain peaks. So their banners saying things like, give us democracy, or sort of more sweary slogans. And when in 2019, there was this movement against an extradition law that Hong Kongers felt would undermine the freedoms that Hong Kong enjoyed and the idea of one country, two systems, which was the principle under which Hong Kong was supposed to be governed. And so there were these banners saying things like repeal the evil law and things like that. And so they had got in touch with me and said, do you want to see us at work? And that was the moment that I really felt my loyalties as a Hong Konger and as a journalist were divided. As a journalist, we're trained to try and be objective and outsiders and report from the outside. And yet, something like this, it was hard to be outside when it's, you know, the place that you feel of as home.
And it forces a kind of tough decision right in the moment. You either can regain your journalistic composure and remember to step back to your arm's length distance, or lean in. Which choice did you make?
So I chose to lean in, and I don't know that it was a choice. It was more of a compulsion. I kind of felt like this was something I should not do, but I just couldn't help myself. So I picked up a paintbrush and started filling in those characters with them. You know, and it was a moment where I did cross the line from an observer into a participant in the act of protest. Part of the reason was because the book that I was writing was a book about this figure called the King of Kowloon, this sort of extraordinary cultural hero in Hong Kong that I'd been so fascinated by. And he was someone who used words and the power of words as a tool of protest. And I just wanted to know what it felt like. But also, yeah, I was compelled.
And because of the rising control of words, it feels like a more dangerous thing to do, a riskier thing to do than it was during the early days after the handover, let's say. I mean, journalists are having their papers closed down. People are being arrested for things they've said and things they've published. It feels scarier now, and certainly in 2019, when you, Louisa, were on that rooftop, than it did in 1999.
That's right. I mean, Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule in 1997. And in 2019, there was certainly a risk in being part of an activity like that. But in 2020, when Beijing imposed its national security legislation on Hong Kong, that's when everything changed massively.
Hong Kong's new security law is in full force with arrests and a very heavy police presence on the ground.
So this is legislation which outlaws sedition, secession, terrorism, and collusion with foreign powers. But these offences are not clearly defined, and they're being very broadly applied. So since they've applied that, 183 people at least have been charged under this legislation. And some of them simply had stickers with banned phrases on them, or banners with banned phrases. But, you know, that banned phrase was Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times, which was a protest slogan that millions of people were chanting for months on end. Other people, just a couple of weeks ago, six people were charged after clapping in a courtroom. This was seen as an act of sedition. So, you know, the way that the law is being used really reintroduces the idea of speech crime into Hong Kong. A third of those cases are speech crimes. And that's something that is quite new. I mean, the possibility was there. There were laws on the statute books, but they were never used under the British. But now they're being used so much that, you know, Hong Kong people say there are no red lines anymore. There's just this kind of red sea with the red lines multiplying out of control.
Well, in 1997, the Union flag comes down. The special administrative region flag, that Hong Kong orchid flag, goes up. And we're told that we're now going to start the clock running on 50 years of Hong Kong being allowed to be Hong Kong. You were already working as a reporter. As a matter of fact, you were covering that story in Hong Kong. Did that sound to you, given what you knew both about the place and about the Chinese, that that had a chance of happening?
I think the point is that there was never any other option. So when this agreement to return Hong Kong to China was signed in 1984, this agreement called the Joint Declaration, Hong Kongers were never at the table. They played no part in the negotiations. They weren't allowed to be there. They did not vote on the agreement. There was no referendum. There was no mechanism by which they could really have a say. So there was no opportunity, no other option. Hong Kong would be returned to China. And when I read these documents that I used in my research that were on a library shelf, I discovered just how hard Hong Kongers had really lobbied to try and get the British to put in some safeguards, put in monitoring mechanisms, so that if China violated the agreement, there might be some kind of redress of some sort. But the British were clearly more interested in political expediency and making a deal. And so they didn't do that, and they argued against it. Hong Kongers always knew they were being returned on a promise, and that promise was dependent on China keeping its word. The first few years, there was a lot of anxiety. People didn't know what to expect. And then things continued as normal. And we were lulled into this sense of security that everything would continue as it has been. But then slowly, there were many protests in Hong Kong, very large ones. At 2003, 2012 about education, 2014 about democracy, the umbrella movement, and then 2019. And now, this year's halfway, we're at that halfway point, 25 years after Hong Kong was returned to China. And that promise is in tatters. Everything has changed. So did Hong Kongers expect it? I think Hong Kongers feared it. They feared that the moment would come. In many ways, it was an impossible promise, and it held water for a while, but you know, as politics in China has also changed. And now I think we see the fallout of what happens when that promise is broken, and the fact that Hong Kongers are leaving in their tens, if not hundreds of thousands.
You know, in those first years, there were British sources, certainly interviews I did around that time, where people said, look, don't worry, because Hong Kong represents such a large portion of overall Chinese GDP. They realize it's a money spinner. They like being able to float shares on the Hong Kong market. They like having a convertible recognized currency to run transactions through. Nobody wants to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. Don't worry. But then China went on 20 years of breakneck growth, and Hong Kong is a rounding error now in the massive Chinese economy. Did that embolden Chinese leaders, successive Chinese leaders, about what they could get away with and what they needed to worry about?
You're absolutely right. A lot of this, the calculations are economically driven, and the role that Hong Kong plays now is very different than the role Hong Kong played in 1997, when it really was the gateway to China. You know, a large chunk of China's foreign currency came from Hong Kong and investment. And now that's no longer the case. As you say, it is like a rounding error. So that historical function of Hong Kong as the gateway to China is no longer as necessary. And I think this is something that factors into Beijing's calculations for the future of Hong Kong. They needed at one point an international city, but now you can invest directly in China. You don't need to go through Hong Kong. And so the future of Hong Kong, as Beijing sees it, is part of what they call China's Greater Bay Area, which is a kind of swathe of cities along the south coast, including Guangzhou and Shenzhen, Zhuhai. But Hong Kong is just one of a number of cities. It's not a preeminent city anymore. So in many ways, I think that is also part of the calculation that China is making, that Hong Kong is being brought back into line. Perhaps as they see it, you know, Beijing has always seen Hong Kong as part of China from time immemorial. So this return to its original status for China is something that not only have they been seeking, they've been telegraphing it with these plans for many years. It's no secret what Beijing wants.
Earlier on, you talked about how the British sort of acceded to Chinese demands. How much of that had to do with the fact that they just didn't feel that they were playing a very strong hand, that they were in no position and saw from the posture of the Chinese at the bargaining table that they were in no position to make demands about guarantees on Hong Kong's future freedom, future status?
I think a lot of it. I mean, the British, even in the language that they used, it was always the language of card playing, of talking about, you know, the hand that they have. And in these documents that I found, which were interviews with these very senior Hong Kong advisors called the unofficials, the unofficial members of the Legislative and Executive Council. So sort of industrialists and lawyers, bankers who had been appointed as advisors to the British. In those papers, but also in recently declassified government documents from the British, you can see this language emerging time and time again. And the British advisors are constantly talking about, you know, the hand that we have is a weak one. And the Hong Kongers are saying, well, make some cards, create some cards. That's what you're supposed to do. But the British, one of the particularly memorable lines that one of the unofficials said was, I would not be so rude as to say it, but it was always our impression that the British were a little bit scared of the Chinese. I mean, you know, the great Chinese threat that Deng Xiaoping had made at a meeting with Margaret Thatcher was, we could march into Hong Kong tomorrow and take it.
不过尽管邓小平已经清楚表明了主权问题不容谈判,
so this was always at the back of the British mindset. And the unofficials, they feared that also the British didn't understand how to bargain with the Chinese. So the British negotiating team was all Brits. There were no ethnic Chinese on the team. There were no native Chinese speakers. And the unofficials feared that they didn't understand the nuances of the conversation. There's this beautiful moment where S.Y. Chung says, they didn't really understand how to bargain. If I went to London and I shopped in Harrods, I wouldn't bargain. I couldn't bargain. But if you come and you shop in a market in Hong Kong, you have to bargain. The agreement that you make is just really the starting point of discussions. And they thought that the British didn't understand that. And I also think there was a certain element of political calculation in it for the British. They feared that Hong Kongers would lose confidence and would emigrate en masse to the UK. And they did not want that. One thing that really emerged that I was very surprised about was just how racist that era was. But particularly the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher herself, was not a fan of the Chinese. She did not like the Marxist-Leninist system. She didn't trust the Chinese. And she even referred to Chinese leaders as savages at a certain point.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. Okay, let's fast forward a quarter century. even the freedoms they were able to enjoy, feel to Hong Kong people like they're quickly eroding, like they're being squeezed, taken away. And the world is seen, a kind of brave, reckless, romantic, but what, ultimately doomed resistance? Is that the conclusion you come up with?
I mean, one of my interviewees said, if the worst thing that we were guilty of was political naivety, then so be it. I think Hong Kongers wanted to hold China responsible to the promises that it made. And for the umbrella movement, China had on at various occasions promised democracy would be introduced at various times and then kept shifting that goalpost forward. And then again, with the anti-extradition law, Hong Kongers wanted to uphold this idea of one country, two systems. I remember I went to see a legislator right when the protests started in his office, and he said to me, we are not asking for the moon. We're only asking for those things that were promised to us. So was that romantic? Was it reckless?
No, but once the authorities make it clear that they are willing to hurt people on the street, detain large numbers, hold them, and take their sweet old time about a trial or charges or evidence, maybe reckless was an inelegant choice, but certainly willing to put their bodies on the line in a way that's breathtaking. Many of those young people, when I listened to them being interviewed, yes, they worried about the future and their place in it and didn't see much of a future in the kind of Hong Kong that China was clearly contemplating. But when forced to make a choice, they were willing to put themselves on the line in an incredibly brave way, which is remarkable. And you just kind of hope that something good comes out of that, but it doesn't look very hopeful right now.
It doesn't look very hopeful right now. Having been on the streets interviewing at a lot of those marches, I was really struck by the degree of political conviction that the protesters had. I was struck by how well-informed people were, and even very young people, you know, interviewing a couple of 15-year-olds at a march, and they were saying to me, you know, just a couple of months ago, we would spend our weekends playing football in the park, playing soccer. And now we're there providing backup for the front lines, tearing up bricks off the street, running away from tear gas. And I said, well, you know, the charge, that counts as rioting. That would be a 10-year sentence, and you're 15, right? That would be, imagine, two-thirds of your life so far. In prison, that's what you're facing. And they just looked at me and they said, we know what we're doing, and we, you know, this is the end game for Hong Kong. And I think people really saw it as the end game. At the moment, Beijing's sort of imposed its end game on Hong Kong now. So the future inside Hong Kong really looks to be one, you know, it's a national security era in Hong Kong where the education, the curricula is being reshaped, even subjects like history and geography are being taught with a national security focus. In the legislature, there's no opposition anymore because almost 47 activists and politicians are still awaiting trial for subversion, for holding a primary poll to choose candidates for an election. But the legislature is patriots only. You know, the civil society organizations in Hong Kong, whether they be trade unions or lobbying groups, many of them have disbanded. As you say, newspapers and digital newspapers have been forced to shut down. It's a very different Hong Kong. But we are seeing Hong Kongers leaving, and we are seeing the birth of Hong Kong communities in exile in other countries.
One important difference is that, unlike in the 1980s, when overnight the British made a Hong Kong passport no longer powerful enough to propel you to the British Isles, Britain seems to be taking a different attitude toward letting people in. When they contemplate their futures under a system more like that in place in the rest of China? An education system, training, the life of free expression, the ability to demonstrate, the disappearance of protest and statues and artwork. Are there people who are saying, this is it. I'm a Hong Konger, but I can't be for the rest of my life.
Yes. I mean, there are many, many people who are leaving. And another very big factor in that is the COVID zero policies. So China has had a COVID zero policy, and Hong Kong has been forced to follow along with this COVID zero policy. And it's a very hard line policy in Hong Kong. They cancelled a lot of flights. Schools have been shut since February. If you test positive, even if you're asymptomatic, you can be sent to a quarantine camp and you can be separated from your children. If your child is COVID positive and you are not, you can be separated for up to 3 weeks. So I think this was really a last straw for many people. And we've seen the outflows of people from Hong Kong, whether they be Hong Kongers or expats, other people, that they've really quickened in the last few months. So 150,000 people have left since the end of December. And in the first 2 weeks of March, the figure was as high as 50,000 people.
Where are they going for the most part?
A lot of people are going to the UK because the UK offered five-year visas for people with a particular kind of passport. But we're also seeing the birth of Hong Kong communities elsewhere. Here in Australia, there's quite an active Hong Kong community. And it's interesting that it is, by definition, now become a very political community. So there's a film about the protest movement, which is banned in Hong Kong. It's called Revolution of Our Times. And it can't be shown in Hong Kong, but they're showing it in cities around the world and amongst the exiled Hong Kong community. And when they put the tickets on sale here in Australia, so many people tried to buy them. The website crashed straight away. And I think they sold something like almost 7,000 tickets in a matter of hours. So these are communities that are sort of highly political, highly motivated, and new communities as well.
Are they mostly people who can get money out, who have training, skills, or multilingual? Are they a kind of world citizen that will leave Hong Kong and leave who behind? Who will be left in Hong Kong when those who have something to lose by staying go and those who have the goods to get out go? Who's left?
Well, in many cases, they are, as you say, sort of very mobile, well-educated young people, particularly people who have decided that they do not want to raise their children in an education system that does not value critical thinking. So in many cases, it's older people who are left behind. But also, Hong Kong has seen a demographic shift since 1997. Since 1997, Hong Kong has given residency to 150 mainland migrants every day. So over the years, that's added up to about 1.5 million new residents of Hong Kong. So that shift has kind of already been underway. And, you know, in many cases, those are the people who are left behind. They're mainlanders living in Hong Kong who have enjoyed the benefits of the freedoms that Hong Kong has been made available. They've been made available to them by living in Hong Kong, but who at this stage will be more compliant, perhaps, than a Hong Konger, will not toe the line. There are also Hong Kongers who are remaining. There are people who just don't want to leave their home. So it's still a mixed picture. But I think that the impact of the COVID zero policies, both in Hong Kong and in the mainland, really cannot be underestimated, particularly as now these kind of lockdowns are spreading across China. You know, up to 40% of China's urban residents are now in some form of lockdown. So I think the economic ramifications of that is something that we can only begin to start imagining now.
I imagine there's no small number of people in Hong Kong who went there to get out of the mainland because things were hot for them there. It was uncomfortable for them there. They might have thought they had no future there. And now that the long arm of Beijing is reaching, able to reach into Hong Kong's daily life, they may find it pretty uncomfortable. I'm sure the government knows who they are and where they are.
That's right. I mean, Hong Kong has always been a place where political dissidents and revolutionaries have lived and have flourished. We have seen a narrowing of that in the last few years anyway, with particularly there were a couple of cases, the most notable of which were when a number of booksellers that worked in a bookshop selling books that were banned in China, they disappeared from Hong Kong and turned up in China in official custody, sort of making these forced confessions on television.
Lam Wing Ki became the fourth of five Causeway Bay booksellers to resurface in Hong Kong. He spoke to the press just over an hour ago, sharing details of his protracted detainment.
I think that was really a moment which, for those type of very political dissidents, that was really, you know, the warning shots that Hong Kong was no longer a sanctuary. And now with the national security legislation, those security agencies that hadn't been operating in Hong Kong before, they're now in Hong Kong. And even the manner in which they arrived was quite Orwellian, you know, a week after the national security legislation was imposed, they moved in the dead of night and they took control of a hotel as their headquarters. So people woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning and this hotel, I think it was called the Metro Park Hotel, it now had a sort of mainland insignia on it. It was now the Office for Safeguarding National Security for the central government in the Special Administrative Region of Hong Kong. And, you know, it just happened overnight with no warning.
Do you have a future in China, in Hong Kong? Are you a person, well, after this book comes out, I'm sure there'll be somebody in an official capacity who will read it. Will things be uncomfortable for you there?
It's possible. At the moment, I wouldn't return to Hong Kong, partly because of my earlier book, because I wrote a book about the legacy of Tiananmen in 1989, where people were killed in and around Tiananmen Square in Beijing. And that has become, in Hong Kong, one of the flashpoints as well. So the Alliance, which is the organization that used to organize huge vigils in Hong Kong, the only place on Chinese soil where such vigils were allowed, that has been targeted by the authorities since the national security legislation was imposed. And people who have gathered for vigils have been found guilty of illegal assembly or even of very Kafkaesque crimes, incitement to incite, incitement to illegal, you know, things like that. And so because I have written a lot about that time, I probably wouldn't return to Hong Kong at the moment.
Are there changing sensitivities around that? You've worked in China extensively since Tiananmen, even since the book came out. Is there less tolerance for a discussion of what happened in Beijing than there was 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
I think so. Weirdly, over time, I think it's a topic that has become more sensitive. As a foreign journalist in China, the red lines have always been made quite clear. You have a reasonably good idea of what you can report and which topics that are more sensitive, where you have to take more care and you have to think very carefully about the safety of your sources. And I think that has always been quite clear. The problem is that in Hong Kong, those red lines really aren't clear at all. There's really no way of navigating them. So I find that the situation in Hong Kong is much more difficult to address as a journalist than the situation in China. And I mean, we see that in Hong Kong as well. We're seeing a number of journalists were arrested from the Apple Daily, but those arrests are still carrying on. A veteran journalist, very well known, called Alan Au, was just arrested. And again, very unclear what the crimes are, or the charges even, in some cases, just the act of posting on social media has been seen as a crime, or the act of calling for sanctions against Chinese officials has been framed as collusion with foreign powers. The fact that the lines are so unclear, that ambiguity is very chilling, because really the only guarantee of self-preservation is silence. And, you know, as a journalist, that is a situation that is intolerable.
If you were looking at the situation from Washington or New York or London and trying to put yourself in the mind of Xi Jinping, who's looking forward to a party congress later this year that will affirm his leadership and stretch it out into the future, you would want a quiet time where people think well of China. But that's looking at it through a lens from Whitehall or Madison Avenue or Capitol Hill. I'm wondering if, from China's point of view, if, in fact, showing the world how powerful you are and that you can reclaim this place, assert your mastery over it, remind the world that you are the power of this century, is something that almost becomes too good to pass up. You're not thinking of it in Western PR terms. You're thinking of it in historical terms that go back further than a lot of people in the West even think about.
I think that's very true. And I think that a lot of the decisions that Beijing makes are not driven by what Washington or Whitehall might think. They're driven by domestic political necessities. The key necessity for Xi Jinping is that he remain in power at the helm of the Communist Party, which remains in control. And almost everything that happens, I think, is working towards those ends. So a lot of the decisions that are made for a political, domestic audience, an audience for whom, as you say, the return of Hong Kong to Chinese rule is really an overturning of 150 years of humiliation at the hands of colonial powers, and something that's very welcome. And I think that is the key audience for Xi Jinping, because in order to keep his primacy, this and the audience of domestic political cadres, of Communist Party members, of those he depends on to keep the Communist Party and the government running, you know, those are his key constituents.
Which does not bode well for the young people of Hong Kong who the world met during the recent protests.
It does not bode well for them, because Communist Party values are in many ways directly opposed to the values that Hong Kongers hold so dear and the values that they were willing to fight for. But it's always so hard to see how these things are going to play out. And I do think very recent events, COVID zero and its impact, the sort of massive discontent that we're seeing in Shanghai, China's richest city, all of those were a wild card that nobody expected. How does China get out of its COVID zero policy without losing face? If it doesn't, how can it possibly continue a COVID zero policy which will have such a massive impact on its economic growth and its ability to actually feed its population? These are questions that are extremely live at the moment.
The book is Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. Its author, Louisa Lim, joined me. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you'd like to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. We're working on an upcoming episode about democracy warriors, people who go to extraordinary lengths, often at great risk, to fight for democratic freedoms. If you have any people you want to recommend, please send an email or voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. And while you're there, please let us know what you thought about today's show. World Affairs is produced by Matteo Schimpf and Andrew Stelzer, with help from Ryan Housel. She's our new associate producer. Welcome, Ryan. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Our CEO is Philip Yun. The music you're hearing is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.